Hi there. Today I'm here with Swiss Actella. He is a software developer originally from Slovenia. He's now working in San Francisco. He has worked with several Silicon Valley veterans long enough to be a Silicon Valley veteran by himself. Swiss, I'm super excited to talk to you about being in the world's capital. How's it going today?
Oh, you know, it's going great. We just fall just started. We have San Francisco has like really weird weather. It's a bit, everything happens a bit late. So fall started. The AI is booming everywhere. There's API billboards on the freeways. Lots of fun stuff around here.
I can imagine. Yeah, it's probably the only region in the world where you get only like tech startup billboards.
Yep.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know you, could you give us like a short introduction of yourself?
Yeah. So I'm Swiss. I've been a software engineer now for, I guess we're starting to count decades at this point. started in Slovenia, worked over there as, I started my career actually in agencies doing web development in PHP and stuff like that. Then I had a solo consultancy where I primarily focused on Silicon Valley startups because I wanted to eventually move over here. Then in like 2014, 2015, I properly moved to SF and I've been living here ever since. Gone through, I think, three startups and a side hustle. So I had
wild times.
Yeah, wild times. Startups. I did the whole journey. I started with three guys in a basement, and we got that to like $1 million ARR. Then I went to a different startup that just raised like a Series A, and then we got to a $100 million Series B round. Built that up. I don't know how far we got to in revenue, and now for about a year and a bit now, I'm at a startup that is like doing crazy things. I think we grew to 50 million in revenue in like 4 years.
Yeah. These are the kind of stories that you hear from SF.
Yep, exactly. And on the side, I like to write books, make courses, write blogs, spend too much time on the internet, all the usual stuff.
All the usual stuff. Love it. So I'm interested, how did Silicon Valley or SF in particular change over, like you have been there for 10 years now? Or
yeah, it has been 10 years. It's really interesting. I think the biggest thing you notice is that in 2014, 2015, when I first came here, everyone would tell you about the mobile app they're building. So you would like talk to a barista at Starbucks and they'd be like, oh yeah, I'm working on this app. It's going to be great. Everyone's going to download it, etc. And now everyone is talking about AI. Now it's like, oh yeah, I have this AI idea. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And at the end of the day, all of the ideas are just rag. It's like you feed a bunch of documents to an LLM, add some search, and then it does autocomplete and stuff. But, you know, that's interesting. And then in the middle, we had the crypto boom. So everyone was talking about the new blockchain they're starting or the new crypto coin or whatever. So it's a very hypey town. You really feel the current hype. You feel a lot. So like back when I came here, React was also big. So I had a friend who did React meetups, and in San Francisco, you would have a React meetup. So just for one JavaScript library and 300 or 400 people would show up.
Wow.
Yeah. Or like right now, Dreamforce is happening right now. So that's the Salesforce conference that they do once a year, where it's just people coming to talk about how they use Salesforce, what they can do with Salesforce, all of that stuff. 60 to 100,000 attendees.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It takes up half of the downtown area, makes traffic awful, and there's literally 100,000 people who just come there to talk about sales software.
I mean, they have their own tower there, so.
This is true. They do have the very tall tower.
Yeah.
But it's like the scale of these things here is just crazy. And like, yeah, every current hype cycle, you really feel it. All the billboards change to whatever the hype is about.
The current
even
thing.
Everything is at the current thing.
Yeah.
And it just changes every 2 or 3 years.
So what does that mean for someone working there? I mean, do you just like pivot between the hype cycles while still being a developer, or is there like a functional progress in people's career?
Great question. So I think a lot of people get caught up in the hype cycles, and it's very easy because the current hype usually has, you know, that's where the money is, that's where you go. It is very exhausting to do that. So I think the people who succeed in this environment have sort of a thing that they do. So it's almost like a productized consultant or like a productized career. I think you said that when we met. I really like that productized career idea. Mm-hmm. So basically the way it works for people is that you have people who are software engineers who can get your company from like series A to series B, or who can get you an off the ground MVP that you can launch and you can then use to test your market. Or they know what to do after your MVP launches and hit some product market fit, how you get to the next stage. Or you have people who are more big company people and they know how to come in when you have 100 people and build your HR until you have 500 people. And then they leave and go to the next company that has 100 people. So it's like almost like, I think Reid Hoffman has a podcast where he calls it doing a tour of duty. So you go into a startup, you do your thing for 2 or 3 years, the thing that you specialize in, and then you go to the next startup. Because like even in an AI startup or a crypto startup, there's like 5 people doing the actual thing the startup is about. And then you have an entire company around them that needs to support everything. So, for example, I'm in I think roughly 120 people startup right now. There's 15 engineers. Everything else is operations, sales, marketing, all of the other stuff that you need to actually build a company that makes money. You have some people making the product, but if nobody is selling the product, if nobody is figuring out how to talk to the market, nobody has those feelers into the market to inform what you need to build for the product, it's not going to succeed. And I think that's probably the biggest difference between Europe and the US, or at least Silicon Valley US, is that in Europe, we're really good at building things. But we're not as good at, or at least in my part of Europe, we're not as good at building the entire company and the whole ecosystem around your product.
Yeah, that's something I've seen also. Like there's a lot of great ideas here in Europe. People start startups and then they have like a pilot client, maybe big enterprise. And if that doesn't work out, it's dead. So this is probably entirely different if you have like 100 people doing sales and marketing for like 15 engineers. That's a lot of different. And the other thing is money access is a bit easier there. It's truly the world's capital.
I was looking, I don't have recent numbers, but back in like 21-22 I was looking. Just the Bay Area got more VC investment that year than all of Europe combined.
Yeah, it's not even a comparison.
Yeah, the numbers are kind of insane, to be honest.
Yeah. So what did all of that mean for your own career? Like, did you do that productized, I have my thing, I hop between companies thing, or did you do something different?
Yeah, It took me a little bit. So I think I had an advantage there because I started as my career as a freelancer. So I did my like student jobs, which is a thing in Slovenia, as like a generic web developer engineer, built a lot of cool stuff. But then I very quickly realized that I like productizing and building early stage things that, so my idea is I always want to work on a product where our customers and our users are the same person, meaning you pay us because we're doing something that you need done, not we attract a lot of eyeballs and then sell users to advertisers or anything like that. So I like the pure exchange of value, which is not always the best for hype trains, but it makes me feel better about my career. So I kind of went from exploring that area into realizing that I really like the architecture and the build, the team building phase of going from, okay, we have a thing that works and that has users that want it. Now, how do we scale this up? How do we get a lot of users? How do we make sure that our architecture doesn't fall over itself? Even things like, how do you go from a product or a piece of software that fits in one person's head to something where you need 30, 40, 50 people to work on it together? And like, so I like that inflection point of the early hockey stick. Mm-hmm. I never was really interested in like fangs or anything like that. The money is nice, but the work sounds super boring. Like a story I always like to tell is I have a friend who spent like 6 months working on replies to replies in Facebook Messenger. And
Or they are inverting binary trees all day.
Yeah, exactly. and that doesn't feel rewarding to me. I like the part of the like of the product life cycle where you're like, oh, we have something that five users really, really want, and they keep telling us the other things that they wish it was doing, and then you have to decide which ones you're going to do, how you can build them, and then finding more people like that, so get that nice hockey stick. So yeah, I guess my thing is building software that happens to run on the web through that early hockey stick.
Okay, so that sounds like a lot of work, because at the inflection point there's a lot of things to consider. Like, would you consider yourself like still as a software developer, or is it more like an architect, or is it like a manager?
I feel like it changes every day. Some days so my official title right now is technical lead manager, which essentially means that I have a management job and a coding job at the same time. So some days I'm very deep in the code. I'm building features, writing, just doing the thing that needs to get done. Other days I'm thinking 6 months to a year ahead. How are we going to shape the architecture? How are we going to get people on the same page? What are the libraries we should use? What our tech stack should be, stuff like that. And then other days is just pure management, making sure we have the right people in place, that we have the skills we need. A lot of mentoring. I really enjoy the mentoring part of what I do, where it's like, how do you get someone who has done React in the past to someone who can write modern React reliably and doesn't break TypeScript types when they sneeze wrong in their IDE? Or I think there's a lot of mentoring that goes into architecture as well. Because architecture is weird in that it's not really well defined. You know, it's like if you write code, you know, okay, it's gonna work. But when you do a system design, it's like, sure, it works, but what's going to happen in 6 months, or what are all of the sharp edges you're going to find? And I think that's where I've had those experiences where I've maintained the same product for four or five years or more. So I know what the, I can tell which of my early decisions turned out to be wrong. So mm-hmm. I can now help others, essentially with, I can share that experience and be like, hey, you know, sharding your database sounds like a good idea, but please don't just, you can get enough CPU and memory. We don't need to shard it and it's going to be fine.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. I mean, this is like a prime example of like over-engineering people sharding their databases. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Totally get it. Or like this is startup life that you just described. You're accountable, responsible for every role, basically. Mm-hmm. And, yep. and you grew up into that point over the course of your career, right? What is the biggest lesson learned from that? I wouldn't say transition, but like evolvement.
I think. The biggest lesson I've learned is that your code really doesn't matter that much. It's more about, does it do the thing? Does it solve a problem that people have? Does it do that profitably? I actually got some signs made that I haven't figured out what I'm going to do with yet, but it says, yes, the code is bad, but does it print money?
Love it.
The idea is that this was a lesson that took me a long time to learn, but my first CTO a few companies ago, I was one of those, I called myself a senior engineer, but I guess I didn't really have the experience yet. I was really focused on, oh, we need to have clean code. We need to have good architecture. We can't have all of this crap lying around. And my CTO was like, dude, stop. Like, none of this is going to matter if we die as a company, because if we die, all of the code is going to get thrown away and nobody's going to give a shit. But if you can make it crappy and good enough, you will then have, as your company grows, I've learned that you will get more resources. You will have more people who can make it better later. You will have more money. You will have more time, etc. So it's like, I now think of it as almost like, you know, you're kind of oscillating between bad and good enough towards a great place. And now that I'm more managery, I'm starting to think more and more in terms of not how we're going to fix this, but who is going to fix this.
Yeah.
And as your company becomes successful, I've learned that you can just hire somebody whose thing it is to fix, like, you can hire an expert who has built their entire career around fixing the thing that is hurting your software. So it's like,
yeah,
hey, your database doesn't scale. Just hire 5 database guys. They'll fix it.
Yeah, or, absolutely.
You know, yeah.
I mean, the point I often see in developers is like they actually transition from being a hobbyist into a career. Like, so they are like really loving the craft, which is not mm-hmm. a bad thing, but it prevents you from taking precedence for business decisions over technical decisions. I see that pattern a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that happened to me because I started programming when I was 9, so it's been a while, and like it was my hobby. I remember, in middle school, early high school, I was like, wait, people will pay you to do this? It's amazing.
Yeah.
I want to be a software engineer. That's so fucking cool. People will just pay you money to write code. That's insane.
I would write it anyways, and now they're paying me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, wow, this is the best thing ever. But over time, I've learned that, you know, you can only build a login form so many times before it becomes boring, or a payment module, or
yeah.
a data visualization or whatever. So now I get a lot more satisfaction from shipping products that make people happy rather than the actual craft of the code, because my users don't really care about the code as long as it doesn't break. But to them, it's not the code breaking, it's the product that's not doing what they want.
Working, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So absolutely. I now see the, I guess, I used to be one of those people who sees the code as the goal. And then eventually I realized that your code is not the goal. The goal is what the code can do for others. So I now see it as a means to an end.
I mean, obviously there's more lessons to it than the biggest one that you just described. And there's a funny coincidence. You wrote a book about it. It's Scaling Fast, Software Engineering Through the Hockey Stick. And funny thing is, I picked a quote from the book, which is like really keeping in that theme. And just for the record, we didn't plan it before. But in a growing business, your goal is to kick the software just far enough to reach the next milestone. Make it work today, then you can make it right tomorrow when you have more time and resources. That is right from the book. It's just what we just described. What else is in the book? Yep.
So the book is about... So I had this hunch a few years ago that software engineering is actually a business discipline. And the main thing that we do is... You know, software engineering is fun because you are trying to achieve a business outcome within the resources that you have. It's not, you know, anyone can build a crazy spaceship, but can you do it on time and on budget, or maybe even faster and cheaper? That's where it's fun. A good quote I saw, I don't know if I put it in the book, but a good quote I saw on Hacker News one day was, anyone can build a bridge, but it takes an engineer to build a bridge. No. Anyone can build a bridge that stands, but it takes an engineer to build a bridge that barely stands. So that's kind of what the book is about. It's about how when you reach that hockey stick, there's essentially three pillars that you have to focus on. You have to focus on growing the business. And it's not a business book, so I just briefly talk about the key things that are good to keep in mind. Mostly as a software engineer, it's good to know that you're in a business that's working. Not in a business. It's zombie startups eat careers. So try to avoid that. The second pillar is building a team because, you know, as Fred Brooks said, it takes a team to build an operating system. You can't do it yourself. Even if you yourself can be personally more productive, nobody's going to wait 20 years for you to build the next Linux. You need a team and you need to work together. So the book talks a lot about how to stay productive, how to work as a team, make it enjoyable, etc. And then the third pillar, which is purposefully last, is the is how to scale the code, where I talk not so much about numerical scaling, like for traffic and stuff, because it turns out that's mostly a solved problem in 2025, when you can, I think, rent a server with terabytes of memory. So I promise you, your servers will scale. You don't need to worry too much about numerical scaling. So I talk more about the architecture and how to make sure that the team that you have can actually work together without stepping on each other's toes and breaking each other's code, and how to have just the right balance of technical debt to making sure it's not going to all just fall apart tomorrow.
Yeah. So, I mean, the book is called Scaling Fast. And I have the same impression as you. Like when people talk about scaling, they usually mean like for traffic, it doesn't scale. We need hyperscalers. We need this and that. And then we need AI to scale the other thing. Neither hyperscaler nor scaling through AI is in the book, and it was just recently released. This is, worth noting for being in 2025, I guess. And I guess it was intentional.
Mm-hmm. I think so. So it was partially intentional, partially just because it took me like 2 years to write this book. So 2 years ago, AI was just starting. We didn't really know what it was going to do yet. But the book is not about AI because all of the things I talk about scaling a team or how to talk to a team, how to lead a team, all of that applies to AI. You can just swap out. Like what I've noticed is that people who have leadership experience get way better outcomes from agentic AI or AI in general, or they're just better able to explain to the AI what the fuck it is that they want. So then the AI can actually do it. And then likewise for, for code stuff, I think AI, it turns out that this actually makes me really happy about the AI boom, is that suddenly everyone cares about architecture and code structure, because it turns out that the things that make code easier for humans also makes it easier for AI, and your AI will be more productive, will give you better results if you structure your code in a way that's better for humans. It makes me a little bit sad that we couldn't talk about this as an industry, or that it wasn't interesting as an industry when it was just for other humans. But you know what? I'll take it. I'm a big fan of code that's easier to work with.
Yeah, I think that's the fine line that you just described before, like making code easier. Don't neglect your unit tests. Provide some documentation is also things that developers feel like, okay, that's just going to take time. So there is already a balance between like the business objective and writing good code and structuring it well. So that might be the reason why we needed someone else, someone artificial to have that angle on that question.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's also easier to observe, because when you're watching the AI struggle, you can see it struggling, and you see what it's doing wrong, and it kind of personally annoys you. And I think most engineers aren't like sitting and watching a team member work while they just sit there and do nothing.
Yeah, that's also true. So keeping in that whole scaling theme, I'd like to zoom out a little bit. You mentioned one of the hype cycles in Silicon Valley was the mobile app era. Mm-hmm. I think there are parallels, because it was a disrupting technology in a way that it suddenly affected like normal people, not techie people, who now care or now have like a super high computing power in their pockets, and everyone was just like, okay, now computing is ubiquitous, so what can we do to make money out of all those people? And now it's a little bit the same feeling, because now AI gives you access to basically any field without having training in that field before, and it's kind of a disruption. So in your opinion, is that similar to what happened before in SF? Because I still get like my whole Twitter timeline is all about SF, people moving there, people loving it, people hating it. It gets another hype and scaling factor. Is that something that we've seen before, or is that what we see now, is that entirely new?
I think it's similar. So during COVID, the Bay Area kind of struggled. People moved out because it's very expensive to be here, and if you don't need to be here, why would you be? So people, especially Americans, are very quick to follow economic opportunities. It's not like in Europe, we like to stay in the city or the village where we started, and then the economy kind of happens around us. In America, it's very common to be like, oh, lost my job, move out immediately the next day. Or, oh, the industry is going poorly, people just move out. Or a new industry starts up, people just come in. Like, even during the gold rush, the way San Francisco started was that there's actually still ships that are sunk in the bottom of the bay, because people would come on a trade ship, bring goods, and then all the sailors would just abandon the ship and go to the hills to mine for gold. And the captain was just stuck there with a ship that nobody could drive, because people were like, I'm in SF now, goodbye. So I think that's just SF in general. It's a boom town. And it kind of feels like over the last 2 years, you know, it's like, it feels like somebody tripped and spilled their bucket of $500 billion on the area. And there's so much money sloshing around in AI that it's just attracting people. It's mm-hmm. people who want to, you know, like the thing you have to understand is that companies that have more money can pay more. So you can be doing the same exact job, software engineering job, somewhere in Europe or in the middle of America or wherever, and you'll make half as much salary as you do here. It's the same job. It's just if you're doing it for an AI company that just got a $50 billion investment, they're going to pay you a lot more. It's going to be harder. There's more competition because if somebody's paying those numbers, they just attract the top talent and then they can hire. They have the choice to hire, you know. I think OpenAI is a good example. A couple of years ago, they were sharing tweets of sorting through, I think, 2,000 resumes per day.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. But on the other hand, they also recently did a tender round where essentially they paid early employees for their shares. And there was enough money paid out that they could buy, OpenAI employees could buy every single house on the that was sold in San Francisco this entire year.
And San Francisco houses are not that cheap.
Yeah, exactly. They're pretty expensive houses. So the thing is, people, so what you're seeing from the outside is essentially people following the money. And coming here because just being here gives you an immediate boost to your salary just from doing things for companies that are making more. So companies that get more investment, that make more revenue, bigger companies, they will automatically, they can pay more because they can afford to pay more. So if you can show that you are, that you belong, that you're good, that you can deliver value, you're automatically delivering more value to a bigger San Francisco company than you are to a smaller company somewhere in Europe.
Mm. Got it.
It's kind of hard to say in words, but I hope it makes sense.
Yeah. So how would you prove it? How would you prove that you can provide value? How do you survive that tremendous value of competition?
Yeah, it's like I think it's basically, it's immediately easier if you come here and figure out how you can make it work just to stay here because now with return to office and everyone being on site, that gives you an immediate boost. People aren't really hiring remote as much anymore unless they're a big company. And then I think the first thing you got to do is just get a job, any job that's in your field, not like, you're not going to prove you're a great software engineer if you work as a barista while you're taking bootcamp lessons on the side. That's a great way to learn and you'll gain your skills, but you need to have that first software engineering job where you're writing code or doing testing or QA, something that puts you in a startup where the startup is growing. And then once you're in there, Do the work, grind. I don't like to say grind. It's more important to be a bit smart about what you're doing, but it does come with some grinding. And then I like to tell everyone to focus on the outcomes and try to join. Make sure you... So that's why the first section of my book exists, is make sure you join startups that are actually going somewhere, that are making money, that are doing, that are growing, because that then looks good on your resume. Mm-hmm. And it is, by going through that inflection, by going through that growth, you will automatically have more growth opportunities. It's very hard to get promoted from mid-level to senior, from senior to staff or whatever. if you are in a company that just doesn't have those positions because it's not growing or because it's shrinking. But a company that is, we tripled the engineering team in the last year. That created a ton of opportunities for everyone who was willing to raise their hand and say, hey, I'll take on the shit work that nobody wants to do so that we can keep growing and doing our thing. And then that automatically creates more opportunities, creates a faster growth curve, and so on. So I guess it comes back to that old saying that opportunity comes knocking dirty and dressed in overalls.
Yeah. Actually, I found that passage on your book as well. I didn't mark it, unfortunately, but it was like you were talking about, like, actually within a growing company, you have less competition because there are like all these positions that you can grow into that they are just created. So there is no competition from the outside. So actually, it's people focusing on getting in the game at all. Like,
How did I do it? So I got in the game kind of. So back in Europe, I was one of those whiz kids who, like, you know, I was in high school and sending out resumes that were like, I think my first internship was like, oh yeah, I can do Python. I just learned Python this weekend. And I learned how to do Python in a weekend because that was a thing I could do back then. I got my first more full-timey job that was still sent. So over the summer, it was full-time. I actually remember taking a break from that job and being like, hey boss, sorry, I got to take 2 months off to study for my matura, which is like the SATs or the high school graduation exam, essentially, and to get into A-levels. I got that job because at the time I was maintaining an open source website building framework that I built myself. And I built my own interpreter for a templating language. And then over Christmas break 1 year, I built a compiler for it so that it was faster. And my boss don't know how he let me do this, but they actually let me run all of the company's websites in my own custom built framework. So I feel bad for whoever inherited that after I left. But I got in the game by basically standing out from the crowd. I was doing things that most other people weren't doing, showing a lot of passion. Like, you know, a high schooler who builds compilers during their school vacation sounds different when they come to an interview than a high schooler who is like, who hasn't coded before or whatever. I also, in Slovenia, we have this cool opportunity where I did a gymnasium that was technically focused. So it was essentially a software engineering high school where I literally had SQL and database courses in my second year of high school, or we learned C and C++, stuff like that. So I think that might sound super discouraging because a lot of that was just, I uniquely fell into it because I took a programming class in third grade and fell in love. But I think the general trend is do something that stands out. I review a lot of resumes these days, and most people just sound exactly the same. It's like, I went to a such and such school and I had the best grades and I did, and I built a website on the side. And it's like, okay, cool. But like, what can you do? What have you done? I got my Silicon Valley jobs partially because, I was writing a lot about software engineering on my blog. This was a long time ago. I don't know if blogs can still do it. I think it's more TikTok now. But I was writing a lot about software engineering on my blog, and it would go viral on Hacker News, and then people would reach out to me. Or I remember launching an app, or back then it was a website. I launched a website that was one of the first searches for Instagram. So it was like Instagram, this was back when Instagram was new. They launched an API, and a week later, that weekend, I was like, oh, this is super cool. I love Instagram. I actually have a user ID that is sub 1 million. So I was like among the first 1 million users of Instagram. So I was super excited about social media at the time. This was like the hype when I was early college. And I keep getting paged. And I basically launched a website that was it was called Hipster Vision, because Instagram back then was about making hipstery photos. And I made a location-based search through their API so that you could type in your city and see Instagram photos from your city or from nearby or whatever.
That was you?
That was me, yeah. Wait, you remember that?
I remember that from Hacker News. I didn't know it was you. Very cool.
Yeah, so that was me. I built that. It went super huge on Hacker News. And then literally, I think 2 hours after it launched on Hacker News, I shipped a quick update that said, hey, I'm looking for freelance gigs. Email me here. And that's how I got some of my first freelancing clients from Silicon Valley. And then because I did well for those clients, one of them basically recommended me to their friend who was starting a new startup and was like, hey, I need someone a bit more experienced. Would you come to Silicon Valley? Would you come live in SF for like 2 or 3 months and help us launch this product that we have an idea and we have a team of, you know, 3 or 4 people who are in college and have never done this before. And like, so I came in as like the experienced guy at 25 or 26, because at least I have done it before. And then, you know, and then it kind of went from there, just small successes building on and then leveraging those up to bigger successes. So like you do a thing and then you start building your network. So I got the company where we first like did a proper hockey stick and went got that huge Series B investment. I got that because at my previous company, my product owner, manager, whatever we call them these days, left, joined a new company that her friend started and was like, we need Swiss. He's like the best engineer I've ever worked with. I really enjoyed working with him. And they essentially poached me to join that startup. That built up more successes. And then the current startup I'm at, I was basically able to use those successes to say, hey, I've done this before. You guys are at the start of an inflection point. I know what you're like. I know what's about to happen to you. I know what the problems are going to be, and I can help you not fall apart when that happens. So they hired me, and then, you know, right now things are going amazingly. We just launched more stuff, doubled revenue in a year, tripled the team in a year, and just kind of grabbing on to a rocket ship and trying to stay on and keep holding on for as long as I can.
Amazing. Some of that sounds so relatable. I did a template engine myself back in the day. One of my first projects, actually. It was done in PHP, which is kind of ridiculous because you could argue that PHP itself is a templating language. But anyway, so I think the time then was a bit different because we were just like, as an industry, we were just like learning. There were a lot of plenty of quick wins. There weren't so many templating language or templating engines. There weren't that many mobile apps. There weren't that many content management systems and stuff like that. And I feel the technology was a lot simpler, a lot easier to reason about, because like in the case of PHP, you would just upload one index.php file and that's it. And then we had this big wave of Ajax, we had some jQuery around that. All of that was pretty easy to reason about if you're like just lock in to say it out loud. But nowadays, if you want to build something, it's like very overwhelming. You need like an entire tool set of transpilers, this and that. And also, every simple thing is already built. So from your experience, those resumes that you looked through, you said, okay, most of them look the same. What were those that did look the same? What did those people do?
So I think that's why we get hype cycles in tech, right? You mentioned that all of the simple things are already built, but I promise you, the way we felt about the web was like, oh, all these new simple things. All of our elders were like, you can already do that on a desktop app, and all the simple desktop apps have already been built. What are you talking about? I actively got advice when I was in high school to not go study computer science, because everyone was like, computer science is over. We figured everything out. Computers are done. There's nothing new to discover. Go do something useful. And I think it's the same now. Like, the reason we had the mobile boom is because the web became saturated, and then we needed a new frontier to open up to unlock new opportunities. Then we had the blockchain and crypto, again, a new frontier with new opportunities, a lot of new things to figure out. And now we have AI, new stuff, new interaction modes, a lot of new stuff to figure out. So I think these days, somebody who stands out is like, they figured out how to do some crazy new thing in AI that was like, you know, I guess I'm looking for people who show that passion to discover, to explore the new things. Like, yes, the web has gotten saturated. It's kind of boring. We have all these complex tool chains and all of the weird stuff, which, by the way, you don't necessarily need. You can still do the simple things. It's just, correct, turns out it's easier to do it with all of the lessons we've learned over the last 20 years. But you can still do it. Like, the startup I'm at was, when I joined, was jQuery, Flask, Jinja, all that old school stuff that feels weird. And then that's what the founders knew, and that's what they could work with. And then they hired experts who can make it better and unlock new abilities. So I think someone who stands out on a resume right now would probably be someone who, I don't know, who in their spare time has like built an agentic tool chain that where you have five agents talking to each other, figuring out and like spitting out apps, or someone who I don't know if somebody actually did this or if they were just talking about it on Twitter, but like, what would it look like to have software that live develops itself as the user is using it, and where the user is like, hey, I need to solve this problem, and the software just builds itself, and then you can talk to it and keep saying, I need these new things, I need these features, and the software self-evolves. So I think someone who's exploring that is definitely, I don't know if they would be interested in what I'm hiring for, but they would definitely stand out.
Yeah, love it. I mean, it's also great like to have a conversation topic in like an interview setting, right? If you can elaborate on what you did and why you're passionate about that, that's already like at least half the time of the entire interview.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have a concrete example for that? What is a project that you've seen from some of your applicants that they built that really made you as excited as they were?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure I can really think of anything specific at the time right now. Actually, here's one. So one of my main questions when I'm doing hiring screens is to talk about the past project and ask, why was it exciting? What was exciting about it? And what did you do there? And one of the engineers we hired had a project that he worked on for an NGO, a nonprofit organization, where he built a mapping visualization of leaf coverage on neighborhoods, because the the NGO was about how we need more trees in cities, and trees are great, and trees provide shade, they make the weather nicer, all of that stuff. And he worked on their mapping visualization so that you could go to any zip code, to any neighborhood in the US, zoom in and see how much shade you get from trees, and how much trees there are, how much green there is. And he built this himself. You know, he was paid for it. It wasn't like a side project. But he was able to talk about it in great detail. He was excited about the things he did. He could show a demo. When I asked probing deep questions, I could very quickly see that he understands deeply what he's talking about. He enjoys talking about it. And yeah, that sort of thing. It's like, it's about, a lot of it is about not so much how big the thing is that you've built. Mm. Obviously, as you grow your career, it should be bigger and bigger, or more impactful, as they say around here. But having that passion, having that depth to like dig, drill down and keep answering questions, and keep going deeper, shows a lot that you deeply understand what you're working with.
Where did you get the images from? Was it satellite data? Or?
I think they combined various satellite data. I think a lot of it was just OpenStreetMap has a lot of really good data already built in. And then I think part of the NGO was, their job was collecting this data and like funding the collection of it. So it was like combining public data with, I guess, also public data, but collected by the NGO, and then making it easy to understand and explain.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, that is a very great example of basically everything that we just talked about, right? I mean, you couldn't get this kind of data like 10, 20 years ago. It was still, I mean, you could potentially from NASA or something, but you would have to pay. It was not accessible. And on the other hand, this is a project that you just described, which is more about like the impact of it than about the technicalities. So it is probably not possible to get some impactful things for your resume by building yet another templating engine, which would
be purely
technical. But you certainly can if you combine relatively easy things these days, right?
Yep. Well, on the other hand, I think the way we built templating engines when we were kids, I think today's version of that would be some sort of language that compiles to AI prompts so that you can, so that it's easier to build things together. And like you're laughing, but there's a bunch of startups right now in YC, in Y Combinator, who got funding to build agentic frameworks. But what that is it's literally just compiling a better structured language into something that AI understands and making sure that you have reusable functions because you don't want to type the same prompt all the time, or that you have variables so that you can change what the prompt is doing and hook them together and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a level of meta hype that just fine.
Yeah, but we were clobbing together HTML and we're like, oh, HTML sucks to write. Let's make this a bit easier. Now you're writing these, your people are writing these 5-paragraph AI prompts, and eventually they realize, oh, wait, I'm just saying the same things over and over. What if I made this a little easier with code?
I totally get it. One last question, maybe, what is your personal outlook on that thing? Because we have had the .com era, the internet didn't go away, and now we do order pet food for our pets. Mm-hmm. The mobile era, it didn't go away. It was probably overhyped, but it didn't go away. We all carry our iPhones with us. Maybe the crypto thing that didn't go away, but still there is Coinbase to some degrees, which is worth 100 million, 1 billion, yep. I don't know. So what is the lasting impact of the hype cycle that we are in now?
So the thing to keep in mind about AI is that artificial intelligence is always a hype. Once it becomes stable and useful, we stop calling it artificial intelligence. My favorite example is programming an elevator used to be considered AI, because only a human can be smart enough to press buttons to make the elevator operate efficiently. Or the first deployment of AI, of a neural network at scale, was USPS reading handwritten envelopes. That was the first like neural network in production running at scale. This was in the 70s. So I think the current AI hype will probably crash. It's very bubbly. Because I'm in it, it's very obvious that there's a lot of money chasing very few ideas. And I think there's going to be a few big ones that come out, kind of like how in the social media hype we had so many social media companies, and we ended up with Facebook, Twitter, and not sure if there's any others that are still really properly around. And now everyone is back on Discord and stuff. But so I think what's going to happen is that what we're calling AI right now is going to become just technology, LLMs, agents, whatever we end up calling it. There's going to be a few really big companies that make a lot of money with it and keep running things. And I think the technology itself is going to stay, and we are, as this hype goes on, as we try a bunch of things and then see what works, the companies that found something that work will stay, and we're going to keep using it in some way or another, probably forever. But that's how the hype goes. You try a bunch of things, and then you prune down to the ones that are useful.
Yeah. I should do a podcast on someone explaining me how that all relates to Lisp and what JavaScript has to do with all of that.
Exactly.
So if you're interested less in predictions and more in practical advice, again, this is your book. This is a preprint version. When will it come out?
So it's coming out in October, November, or probably early November. We're setting everything up right now. If you go to scalingfastbook.com, you can sign up to be notified when pre-orders go out. Book will be launched probably early November.
Yeah, we put the link down in the show notes. Thank you, Swiss. That was an awesome conversation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.